supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The first medical marijuana dispensary in southeastern Pennsylvania opened its doors today. Doctors there saw patients who already had secured medical marijuana cards. WHYY's Nina Feldman sat in on a consultation.
Keystone Shop's first dispensary is located on Lancaster Avenue in Devon in an old Dairy Queen. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Louis Van de Beek was on hand to meet with clients who'd made appointments for opening
what
day.
What brings you in today, Bobby?
I was diagnosed with cancer about a year ago, and I've been going through chemotherapy.
Bobby Brown lives in Bucks County, about an hour drive from Devon. His sister brought him to the dispensary straight from his last chemotherapy session. While he was in treatment, a friend gave Brown some CBD droplets. That's the compound in marijuana that's not psychoactive. It really helped him.
How did that seem to help you? What effect did that seem to have?
Actually, it sort of like mellowed me out, like not really high or nothing, but it just felt like...
Not so tense, less worried,
you know,
more relaxed. Mm-hmm.
That's Bobby's sister chiming in. Together, Dr. Van de Beek and Brown figured out what would be the most appropriate for him based on his past use of the drug.
I've smoked pot since 1963.
And his preferred method of ingestion.
Are you comfortable inhaling through a vaporizer?
Yeah, I'd rather have the drops that come, you know.
From there, the doctor handed Brown off to the store technicians, who helped him choose a product based on the doctor's suggestions. Keystone Shop's grand opening is tomorrow, but their stock is low. That's because even though the state has approved 11 growers, only one of them is ready with supply. That means prices can be kind of high.
Cool, so today's total is going to be $146 even.
And since insurance does not cover this, it's all out of pocket. By the end of the weekend, there will be a total of 6 dispensaries open across Pennsylvania. Nina Feldman, WHYY News.
Rochelle Faroul is a 33-year-old black woman. The Northwestern University College grad had a good credit score and guesses she was making around $60,000 a year while teaching computer programming as a contractor for Rutgers University 2 years ago. That's around the time she tried to purchase a brick row home near Malcolm X Park in Philadelphia, but she had a lot of trouble getting a mortgage, and those difficulties are rampant for applicants of color in Philadelphia, as well as dozens of other cities nationwide studied in a new report. Emmanuel Martinez is a data reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX and co-author of Kept Out, For People of Color, Banks Are Shutting the Door to Home Ownership. Emmanuel, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
First, let's hear from her.
It was humiliating. That's where a lot of my bitterness comes from. I was made to feel like nothing that I was contributing was of value, like I didn't matter.
Emmanuel, described the situation whereby Rochelle was made to feel humiliated.
That was Rochelle talking about her experience in trying to get a mortgage in Philadelphia. She tried multiple times, and her story shows that, you know, there were things that she needed to do that didn't seem to be enough to get those mortgage. Like, she was told to get a full-time job. She got the full-time job. It didn't seem to be enough. And that's kind of like the story that we've heard from, you know, several people that we've interviewed, people of color, applicants of color, who have tried to get a mortgage, but it seems to be that there is always this fishing of reasons to say no to them.
So let's step back and review the legacy of what's known as redlining and what were thought to be attempts to end it 50 years ago.
We looked at two laws, the Fair Housing Act and the Community Reinvestment Act. The second piece of our series focuses on the Community Reinvestment Act, and that was signed into law in the 70s, I believe, and banks are required to lend to quote-unquote blighted communities to make an effort to make to those laws. Unfortunately, the law is race neutral, and it did not foresee gentrification. So you have all these banks getting credit for lending in blighted neighborhoods, but the loans are going to white applicants. They're not going to people who live in those communities.
What is the disparity?
It varies from place to place. For example, in one neighborhood in Point Breeze, that neighborhood stood out in terms of the fact that It was one of the few neighborhoods in Philadelphia that is majority black but has received a large volume of loans, and most of those loans are going to white applicants.
Philadelphia City Council member Cindy Bass once worked for a mortgage company, and she does not mince words in describing this situation.
It's an economic form of racism.
Is that one of the primary findings in your report?
I would say that there is a lending disparity in terms of when you look at the whole picture, you know, that people of color in Philadelphia, black applicants are almost three times as likely to be denied. And you compile that with where banks are located, the overwhelming majority are located in white neighborhoods.
What is the median net worth disparity at this juncture?
So right now, the disparity is about $9,000 for a black family compared to $132,000 for a white family.
That you looked at patterns nationwide, is Philadelphia one of the more egregious examples?
Nationwide, Philadelphia is one of the largest cities that has one of the widest lending disparities. In Philadelphia, black applicants are nearly three times as likely to be denied a conventional mortgage than their white counterparts. Aside from looking at just lending disparities for people of color, we were able to compile data at the neighborhood level, at the census tract level, where we look at the lending patterns in specific neighborhoods and able to compare them to the demographics of that neighborhood, as well as looking at the lending patterns for these lending institutions in all markets. If people are curious about the lending disparities in their neighborhood, they could text LOAN, L-O-A-N, at 202-873-8325.
So were you back home in California crunching all these numbers, or did you, for example, come to Philadelphia?
I spent most of the time analyzing the data here in our office in Emeryville. Then, you know, once we decided as a news organization that we were going to focus in on Philly, I made a trip out to Philadelphia, and it was interesting to see what I was seeing in the data. I was able to map, you know, the Philadelphia Metro Division, map out the demographics, map out the lending, where the lending is happening. And it was really surreal to see that in person.
Emmanuel Martinez, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Emmanuel Martinez is a data reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX and co-author of Kept Out: For People of Color, Banks Are Shutting the Door to Home Ownership. The radio version of this story will air on Reveal Sunday afternoon at 4 on WHYY-FM. Also, this Sunday at noon on The Pulse, separate Black Health in America focuses on local and federal laws that drove people into separate neighborhoods and why some of those patterns remain. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight. A recent move by the Trump administration is sending shockwaves through the solar energy industry. The president last month imposed a tariff on imported solar panels. State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk looks at what this means for the state's solar industry.
Surrounded by press in the Oval Office, President Donald Trump uncaps a big felt-tip marker to sign this proclamation.
A very important executive action to protect American jobs.
He imposes a 30% tax on solar panels manufactured overseas. This tariff is set to expire in 4 years, and he wants it to send a message to the rest of the world.
Our companies will not be taken advantage of anymore.
By competitors like Chinese manufacturers. See, China's government has subsidized solar manufacturing, making its panels so cheap that American companies found it difficult to compete. So they asked the federal government to impose a tariff on all foreign-made panels to level the playing field. Trump granted their wish.
And our workers are going to have lots of really great jobs with products that are going to be made in the good old USA.
But it's unclear whether those jobs are coming. The tariff could lead to more jobs in manufacturing. It could also result in more expensive solar panels. If that happens, people and energy companies might not be so keen to go solar, and that would hurt jobs in the installation side of the industry. In fact, the nation's leading solar trade group claims the tariff will kill 23,000 jobs. That's roughly a tenth of the industry's workforce. But in Pennsylvania, Ron Celentano with the State Solar Energy Industries Association paints a less dire picture.
We're certainly going to be affected by this, you know, in the state, but I don't think it will be a showstopper. It's not going to just slam the door shut.
See, Pennsylvania doesn't have solar farms with rows and rows of solar panels. Those big utility-scale installations in places like California operate on tight margins. A slight change in price could break a project. Most solar installations here are small. Think rooftops of homes and buildings. Celentano says those customers are motivated by more than just price.
People are just getting more on board with wanting to do solar.
Because it's clean, emissions-free energy, and they may be open to paying more for it. As for the cost, analysts at Bloomberg expect the tariff will lead to a 3% price increase in residential solar installations. And these projects don't come cheap. Here at the new Forest Hills Municipal Building near Pittsburgh, over 400 solar panels cover the rooftop. Workers from the local solar installer Energy Independent Solutions are finishing up the wiring inside. Hal Saville helped develop this nearly $400,000 system. The panels come from an American-owned company, but they were made in Mexico.
In this case, the tariff isn't going to impact them at all because they were already sold. So that's a good thing. So we're more concerned about what's going to happen going forward.
Whether the tariff will make projects like this unaffordable. I caught up by phone with the president of Saville's company to talk about this. Joe Morinville says when rumors about a potential tariff began to circulate in late 2016, companies with projects in the works stocked up on panels.
They bought everything the market had available because they didn't want to get stuck, you know, buying these modules at a 30% tariff.
He noticed prices for some parts climbed 26% before Trump even announced the tariff. So he's not anticipating a major swing in price going forward because it has already happened. Amy Sisk, State Impact Pennsylvania.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between WHYY, WITF, WESA, and the Allegheny Front, covering the Commonwealth energy economy. What can the health of our pets say about our well-being? In Wilmington, Delaware, a new free veterinary clinic hopes to connect owners with care for themselves while getting their pets on track. For WHYY's Health Desk, Kyrie Greenberg reports.
So I can get the vet student to come and ask the history questions for you, right? We work.
Theodore Trivett and his dog MJ arrived early at the Henrietta Johnson Medical Center to be sure they got a walk-in appointment. He's had her since she was a month old.
Oh, she's my best friend. She's my child. She's my daughter. Anything you think of. I live on the streets before I get rid of her.
MJ is four now, and she's never had her shots. Trivett says he knows a trip to the vet is way overdue.
Because I did price out like what it'll cost to get everything, and it's almost $200.
Right now, they live with his grandparents while he attends automotive school. And that $200...
it's a lot. It's like $1 million, actually, because I've experienced being homeless, so I know the true value of a dollar. And a dollar is a meal, actually.
The free clinic, now in its fourth month, is packed and sees about 20 pets each session. Each table has three veterinarian students supervised by senior vets. Among the tables are clinic staff and student nurse practitioners who ask about the humans' access to medical care and whether they have health insurance.
And what I tell people is dogs don't need willpower.
It's our willpower, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Shay Scott is CEO of the medical center. She says by hosting a vet clinic, she's hoping to reach more people who are eligible for low-cost medical care and sign them up for appointments during regular hours.
Sometimes people who don't necessarily take the best care of themselves will take care of a pet or spouse, someone else. So the notion that they're coming here now is an opportunity for us to tap into their primary care as well.
Troya Banks came for a follow-up appointment with her four chihuahuas.
This RJ, Rusty, Crybaby, and Coco.
Her mother is a patient at Henrietta Johnson and gave her a flyer.
I've been having to take care of my husband because he's been sick. I'm not working right now, so we weren't able to take the dogs to the vet anymore.
The dogs still need dental work, but are looking much better after antibiotics and heartworm medication.
Wow, does she ever kind of like lift her leg a little bit and put it down?
Patrick Carroll from the Delaware Humane Association says the partnership is part of their One Health plan, which uses pets' health as a window into the health of the family and environment. Pharmaceutical companies and pet care brands support the effort, with student volunteers coming from three area universities.
By being in a facility that is about human health care, then we can connect the dots to their own health care. If their pet is overweight or their pet has skin issues or diabetes, we can talk about that. That's an issue with humans as well.
The clinic is held the first Saturday of each month between 8 a.m. and noon. For WHYY News, Kyrie Greenberg.
At the onset of this President's Day weekend, let's tap into public regard for more recent chief executives, starting with number 35, John F. Kennedy. Joining me with more is Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, why don't we start with JFK, who took office in January 1961.
And he left office, of course, when he was assassinated in November 1963, a long time ago. But we just ask Americans, looking back, do you approve or disapprove of how these presidents handled themselves when they were president? John F. Kennedy is the highest of the bunch. 86% retrospective job approval rating for John Kennedy. That is, people now looking back almost universally say he did a good job while president. And what's interesting about that, of course, Dave, is that a lot of young people are really positive about JFK, who weren't even alive when he was president. But looking back, he gets these very, very high ratings, of course, perhaps due to the fact that he was assassinated while in office and kind of became a saint on the day after that assassination.
We'll fill in the middle, but who was least regarded?
Richard Nixon. He left office in 1974 in disgrace, of course, as a result of Watergate. 28% retrospective job approval rating for Nixon, 64% disapproval for Nixon. So even after all these years, when people look back at recent presidents, Nixon's at the bottom of the list. He still gets very, very low approval ratings when people think back to his administration.
Quite a disparity between Kennedy and Nixon. What is a more typical response?
Well, a lot of these presidents are right in the 60% range. Barack Obama's is very important. This is, in fact, our first retrospective approval rating of Obama. That is the first time we've asked people now looking back. It's been about over a year since he left office. Do you approve or disapprove of how he handled himself as president? 63% approval. Over 8 years, Obama just had an average in the 40% range. So he's clearly doing better in retrospect now than he did while he was president. He's very similar now to George H.W. Bush. That would be Bush the senior, who served one term. And also Bill Clinton, who's at 62% retrospective job approval rating. Although I should say, Bill Clinton's retrospective rating is down some from where it was a few years ago.
I might conjecture that Bush the junior also enjoys higher approval now than he did toward the end of his presidency.
That's absolutely right. His approval ratings were really dwindling in 2007, 2008, when he was about to leave office, way down in some instances in the 20% range, but in the 30% range. But now when Americans look back and we say, do you approve or disapprove of how George W. Bush handled himself as president, he's getting a 53% retrospective rating. Now, that's lower, as we've been talking about, than a lot of his contemporaries, but still his image is edging up now over 8 years after he left office.
This is a snapshot, and I'm wondering the extent to which these perceptions evolve over time.
Generally speaking, people get a little more positive about presidents as time goes on. Ronald Reagan is a good example. He left office in 1989, and his retrospective ratings weren't all that great and the years thereafter. But since then, they've been going up and up. And now he gets 72% retrospective job approval rating approval. So Reagan's image has improved over the years since he left the office.
Now, Frank, to be clear, it's not a prerequisite that respondents are necessarily even alive evaluating, say, Kennedy or Nixon.
That's absolutely right. And that's what's fascinating about these ratings, because a lot of people weren't alive when Kennedy or Lyndon Johnson or some of the others were in the White House. We're asking people, thinking back now, what do you think about these people when they were president? However, on Kennedy, I should point out that while he was president in those 1,000 days while in the White House, he had the highest contemporaneous approval rating of any president we've ever measured. In other words, people liked Kennedy when he was in office. And now retrospectively, looking back, they like him retrospectively. So that's quite an interesting contrast to, say, Ronald Reagan, whose ratings were lower while he was in office, down in the 50% range average, but now he's getting over 70% retrospective approval rating.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. Assistant news director, Katie Colinari. John Busoni is assistant vice president for news operations. At the helm this week, Bob Alls, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. Newsworks Tonight.